Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Quick note, this is part two of a two-part series. So if you have not listened to part one on the life and times of Lewis Wayne, please pause and come back to see us in part two. We'll give you a second. That was a second. Welcome back. Hi, I'm Ben.
We are working in podcast time, which is basically an infinity. We were just talking about how we have lost all sense of time and space as pertains to how many of these episodes we've done in quarantine, how many of these episodes we've done in general, and that was all because of our amazing special guest today and on our previous episode, Gabe Luzier, research associate here, not only in spirit, but in the virtual flesh. That sounds like some David Cronenberg stuff right there. I'm Noel, by the way, and you're Gabe.
I am Gabe, yeah. And I'm thrilled to be back talking Lewis Wayne. I think we're all in the right headspace for the next part of this story and where it's going to go, because it does get a little strange from here.
Yeah. You know, one thing earlier when we were talking about this episode, as we were doing some research and we're getting ready to go on air, super producer Casey Pegram was, I would say, dare I say, super enthusiastic about the art, Casey, what's the French word? The oeuvre,
the oeuvre. Yeah.
Yes.
You mean the oeuvre? Mr. Wayne. The oeuvre?
The oeuvre. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Casey on the case. The body of work. And so we all are, I would say, in an appropriate headspace. So previously in part one, we talked about the origin and the growth of Wayne, Lewis Wayne, and his career. But you may have noticed there were a couple of threads sinking in there, a couple of maybe discordant notes to this artistic symphony. And when we left Mr. Wayne, he was known as this the last word in fanciful drawings of felines. And these cats, these depictions, they became more and more action-packed. They became more and more surreal, absurdist. And now we're at a point in Wayne's life where people are making an assumption that seems weird, but feels very logical for them at the time, where they're like, look, he draws so many cats. He loves them so much. He's not just an artist, right? He's got to be like a cat expert, a catspert.
Yeah, yeah. I think people just kind of looked at his body of work and were like, oh, this guy knows cats. Yeah, he must know everything about them. And so he was actually elected president of the National Cat Club in 1890. And from there, he went on to host its annual cat show in London. He served as president for 5 years, but, you know, he was on the committee for much longer than that. And all of this, you know, despite the fact that he really didn't know anything about cats. I mean, he had a couple of his own and he was obviously a fan, but even if you look at his artwork, he did not really keep in mind their anatomy. He wasn't really hemmed in by, you know, the logistics of actual cats. He sort of had them do whatever he wanted. And he had some pretty outlandish ideas about them, you know, what they were capable of. He actually had some strange theories about striped tabby cats in particular. He thought there was something going on with their bodies in terms of magnetism. He once wrote on the subject, quote, "Strangely enough, I once had the impression that a cat's tendency was to travel north and to face north as a magnet does, and that this tendency had some intimate association with the electrical strength of its fur."
That is a reach right there, my friend.
Yeah, little bit, right? And yeah, but, you know, people kind of took it at face value. This guy knows cats. Let's put him in charge of the cat club. And yeah, it just kind of went from there.
Quick aside, Gabe, I'm sorry to cut you off. Does that mean in theory, based on this theory of Wayne's, that you could use a cat like as a compass to find true north, just like hold it out like a divining rod and see where it takes you?
I do believe it does, yes. And also, according to Wayne, if you wanted to keep a cat away, all you had to do was sprinkle some orange peels around. According to him, cats detested the smell of oranges and would just steer clear. If you laid a continuous line of peel across your garden wall, the cat would not cross it.
Okay, so he's like the predecessor of Charlie Day in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia with his cat theories. Okay, there you have it, FX. We've mentioned our requisite quota of one Always Sunny reference per season.
Do you think he was just making this stuff up because they were casting him as a cat expert, that he felt like he needed to weigh in on some stuff that no one else would be able to know or verify?
Yeah, I mean, you know, people kept asking, so he gave them good answers, I guess, or at least entertaining ones. And nobody really questioned it because he kind of had become this beloved public figure. His work was everywhere. It was on those, you know, thousands of postcards that I mentioned, but, you know, they were also selling posters of his art. He was appearing in illustrated children's books, on billboards advertising tea, jigsaw puzzles. The guy was everywhere. You know, way more fame for, you know, a cat artist at the time than, you know, anybody else had. And the other thing that really, you know, took off for his career was he started publishing these annual magazines. And so this would be, you know, a collection of his illustrations along with short stories and essays from him as well as other, you know, writers of the era. And it kind of just became a public fixture. Everybody, Wayne's art was everywhere.
And there were also, you know, it's strange because we have the benefit of retrospect, right? We can look back at some of his statements and say, hey, this might have been, you know, not maybe a red flag, but maybe a yellow card, you know, as far as the state of his mind, where he would say those things, you know, like you pointed out, Noel, and like you contextualized, Gabe, he would say stuff on record to papers of and publications of note that sounded extraordinary. And it sounded like something maybe you would say if you had a Tim and Eric sense of humor, but he was, as we found, very serious. Like, he believed this stuff. And still, people ate it up. They loved this eccentric cat expert, this, you know, this master of all things feline, and they went to him for this advice. And people love these annuals, and they had essays, right, from people of note. He is blowing up. Eventually, he leaves and he crosses the Atlantic and he comes here to the U.S.
Yeah, that's right. He got a job working for the Hearst newspapers in New York City, and he stayed there doing comic strips for 3 years, actually. And he actually only came back to London because his mother passed away. And yeah, he again had to kind of fill that role of breadwinner for his sisters.
It's crazy though, man, because the guy was absurdly talented in an extreme way. He, you know, was a lefty, but he could use both hands for drawing, and he could perform tricks like he could like write backwards, like write mirror images. And he also could pump out as many as 150 cat drawings in a single hour. You know, understandably wouldn't be like the super high detail ones that you would see like in some of these high profile publications, but he wasn't just limited to one particular medium, as you're going to see as his career progresses. He would do crayon or watercolor, oil paints, pen and ink. I mean, he was absolutely kind of a Renaissance man of cat painting.
Yeah, yeah, that's a crazy point. He even his musical creative drive never fully left him either. He even wrote an opera. He, you know, was the king of the emperor of postcards. For a while, Wallace Stevens should have written something about that, but this is, that's besides the point. I just like the Emperor of Ice Cream, but we see that his career is blossoming, but the guy was so talented and so driven that he would have there's an argument we could make that he would have probably been this prolific had he not been selling stuff, right? And there were so many sets of things out there, millions and millions of sets. And later observers and analysts and critics say that he invented different iconic postcards. I think they specifically point out the striped cat, the spotty cat, the cats, you know, caught in the midst of sport. And let's see, he didn't just crank out sketches. He also did like full on paintings, and the paintings were copied. It reminds me a little bit of a cooler Thomas Kincaid. You guys remember Thomas Kincaid, right? The artist.
Oh yeah, definitely.
The painter of light.
Yeah, no, with Thomas Kincaid, you know, that guy's paintings have been copied more and more often, right? They're everywhere, but Kincaid actually doesn't make most of those now. He's sort of a brand name, but from what I understand, Wayne was always making the original works, correct? He was just making tons and tons of them.
Yeah, that's right. And unfortunately, you know, he was handling the sale of those all on his own. He never had an agent or anybody to kind of negotiate fees for him with publishers. And, you know, as a result of that, you know, the fact that he was just kind of this shy, kind of soft-spoken businessman, kind of on his own, drawing cats, which, like you said, he probably would have been doing anyway, even if he hadn't been being paid for this. When he was selling his work, he really kind of didn't stand up for himself, didn't negotiate fees. He actually never even retained the copyright to the work that he was selling. So once it was out there, people were free to kind of reuse this as they wished. And they did. He kind of became really overexposed because of it. His artwork was just being reproduced for magazines that, you know, he wasn't being paid for.
I was going to ask about that, because even in those days, I mean, the idea of intellectual property was certainly not as ironclad as it is today. And honestly, yes, he absolutely had a style, but anyone can draw cats doing cute stuff, can't they?
Yeah, well, not like Lewis Wayne could, but
fair. But what I guess what I'm getting at is, like, this could have, I imagine, led to copycats and but, you know, I mean, especially if he didn't own, you know, he had no trademark behind his brand, that would make it even easier to do this. But again, his thing really is just kind of cats, maybe wearing pants, doing kind of human-y things. And that became maybe eventually more the recognizable thing than him as a name or as, like, you know, the person behind it. I'm mm-hmm. just spitballing here. I'm asking yeah. you, Gabe.
No, that sounds right. I would imagine there were definitely copycat artists, and people probably looked at it and thought, oh, that's a Lewis Wayne, you know, at it again.
Yeah. I mean, how would you? How could you put a patent on a concept like that that's so open to interpretation? And the problem is that Wayne's lack of maybe business sense or financial acumen didn't stop at copyrights for his style. Like, you could say maybe he was a little too trusting. I'm sure many of us listening today know how awkward irritate, sometimes painful, negotiating anything can be. So he probably wanted to get back to what he actually liked, which was drawing these cats, making these paintings. But we see that, like, a couple different times he tried to branch out into investments of sorts. And just like Mark Twain, who was also a terrible, terrible investor, he didn't have much luck. I think when his mother passed, he had put a lot of money into an unsuccessful patent for a lamp or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he patented a few inventions. Nothing really ever came of them. It's kind of like with the opera. The opera has been lost to time, and kind of the patents as well. There's documentation of him talking about this, and yeah, he evidently dumped a lot of money into the development of it, but it never really went anywhere. He basically, you know, he had fame from his work, but he did not have fortune. And yeah, like you said, that comes down to his lack of business sense. He would basically give this stuff away. He would even take commissions from well-to-do families, you know, people who had the money to pay for this, but he just didn't ask for any money, and it never came up. So he would do a lot of work just for free.
And then again, he is, as you guys said, he is oversaturated the whimsical cat drawing market, which he created, to be fair. And more people were saying, well, I've got your annuals, you know, I've got plenty of postcards. Don't get me wrong. I love them, but I can only have so many pictures of fanciful cats. And then World War II is on the horizon. You know, this 1907. He meets this sort of cavalcade of terrible personal events. His mother passes away, as we mentioned. One of his sisters passes away after having spent several years institutionalized in an asylum. And then his other sister passes away. Like, his first sister passes away institutionalized in 1913. Another sister passes away in 1915 during an epidemic of the flu. And we want to be sensitive about this, but his own mental state appears to start declining around this time.
Yeah, I mean, we know now that things like schizophrenia are passed down, you know, through generations. And it would appear, and it's interesting too, when you look at the progression of his work, they get more and more kind of, I mean, psychedelic is the word really, but it does paint a picture of a deteriorating mental state. Let's put it that way. And I don't mean that to say that's, you know, psychedelic style always points to that. But, you know, he started off much more formal. And then as his work progressed, it got way more just kind of out there. And like, you could really see it as kind of a visual representation of what was happening to him psychologically. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it's tough to talk about this stuff and say for certain, you know, with any kind of certainty, but it seems to me like, yeah, this condition was something that was kind of, you know, latent within him for his whole life and probably was masked to a fair degree by just kind of his reputation for being so eccentric and, you know, such a strange guy. People maybe overlooked some of those telltale signs. But I think, yeah, it was after he had to return home after his mother's death and kind of, you know, take on all those domestic responsibilities again, especially at a time when his career was kind of in a decline. The money wasn't coming in. And meanwhile, you know, you can hear the sounds of World War One like constantly right across the channel. I think he was under a lot of pressure and it finally got the better of him. The thing that kind of really made his friends and family suspicious was he started kind of soliciting their help for this non-existent cat show that he claimed to be organizing, and talking about this the scheme he had to breed spotted cats. I don't know, you know, the details of it, but it was enough to kind of alarm the people close to him. And things just kind of got more sinister from there. He started believing that his surviving sisters were actually the ones responsible for his other sister's death. He thought they were stealing money from him, hiding his possessions. And he also, kind of towards the end of this period, started claiming that groups of spirits were projecting electrical currents so that he would become full of electricity. And, you know, to hide from that, he kind of shut himself in his room and was writing all of these theories out. He began moving furniture around endlessly, just kind of rearranging it. And I guess that was in his mind, you know, he thought that doing that would keep his sisters from taking the furniture and selling it out from under him. And unfortunately, these tendencies eventually turned violent. He started to attack his sisters, and they just kind of had to call the doctor one day. And on June 16th, 1924, Lewis Wayne was certified insane. At the time, that was, you know, the wording they used. And he was admitted to the pauper's ward of the Springfield Mental Hospital.
Let's just remember, too, that this was not a good time for mental health. There was stigma surrounding it. The treatment of folks going through these situations were barbaric, to say the least. And you know, as evidenced by the notion of a pauper's wing of a quote unquote insane asylum.
Right. No, exactly. And yeah. There were, you know, kind of upstanding institutions at the time, you know, sanatoriums, but this was not one of those. Yeah. At this point he was broke. So yeah, he went to the pauper's wing and probably didn't get the best of treatment. Thankfully he was not there long. He was there about a year before somebody actually kind of stumbled upon him there, you know, the great Lewis Wayne. And it's a pretty great story. It's actually this bookseller, a publicist, and I had never heard of this, but he was a Fabian, which is actually like a kind of a socialist reform group.
Yeah, they're still around now. They're still around now, the Fabian Society. Really? Yeah, yeah, yeah. They've actually been, one of their more recent fights is to get the British press to stop using the word chav as often because it is seen as stereotyping and derogatory toward the working class. I was just reading about the Fabian Society. But yeah, they're fighting the good fight, and they took up this, it took up this flag. I want to step back just a couple points. Noel, you took the words out of my mouth for the asylum, and thank you for doing so. There are some fantastic books about the horrors that went on there that I'd be glad to recommend if anybody wants to reach out online. And the stuff about electricity that you mentioned, Gabe, I would say you can see some of that reflected in how he's drawing these cats. So just want to make sure that we establish those two points. Don't forget those. With the Fabian Society, I believe you're introducing a savior of Wayne, and that's Dan Ryder, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Dan Ryder. He was touring the hospital where Wayne was committed, and he kind of just stumbled across him. He says he wrote this down later in his memoirs. He said, "I was on a committee that had to visit asylums. During one of those visits, I was passing up and down a corridor when I noticed a quiet little man drawing cats."
Ooh, ooh, can we do a, you want to do a reenactment? Gabe, how about you be the narrator? Noel, do you want to be Dan Ryder or do you want to be Wayne?
I'll be Ryder. Okay. That's okay.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
Take it away.
All right. "Good Lord, man, you draw like Lewis Wayne."
"I am Lewis Wayne,"
replied the patient.
"You're not, you know,"
I exclaimed.
"But I am,"
said the artist. And he was.
I think that was worth it. Was that worth it?
Well, yeah. Done.
Yeah. Totally.
And this blew Ryder's mind, because at first he didn't fully believe it, but then he kind of became an advocate for getting him the hell out of this situation.
Yeah, he actually spearheaded this public campaign. He got noted writers of the time. He got H.G. Wells on board. H.G. Wells actually had a great quote that he said on radio. He said, "Lewis made the cat his own. He invented a cat style, a cat society, a whole cat world. British cats that do not look and live like Lewis cats are ashamed of themselves."
Do you think that this would have predated T.S. Eliot's, stories about cats and all of those poems? And do you think that was influenced by this? Sure seems like it to me. I don't know.
I think that's a great observation. T.S. Eliot, you know, despite what he wanted everyone to believe, was not himself British. He was just an Anglophile. That guy was born in Missouri. He wrote Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats in 1939. So the timeline definitely matches up. I think that's a really good catch. I just also want to point out that there's pretty solid evidence H.G. Wells plagiarized the heck out of stuff, but he did not plagiarize that quotation. That is verified.
That was from the heart.
That was from the heart. So this feels like maybe, you know, we're in a better place, hopefully, right? We've kind of followed a Joseph Campbell-esque hero's journey. We've gone to the dark night of the soul. He's been rescued by a fan, and everybody else thought he was dead. He gets moved to a better psychiatric hospital at first, right?
Yeah, and I have to throw in there that even the prime minister of the time got on board this effort to kind of rescue Wayne. He was, such a cultural figure at the time. The prime minister actually went on the air and said, "Lewis Wayne was on all of our walls 15 to 20 years ago. Probably no artist has given a greater number of young people pleasure than he has." And that really did strike a chord with the public. This appeal raised £2,300, which of course quite a bit more today. I think it's somewhere around over $100,000 for sure. And so that's the effort worked. He got transferred to a better facility, Bethlehem Psychiatric Hospital in London, and then 5 years after that, he was transferred again. And where did he end up? He ended up at Knapsbury Hospital, which apparently had, you know, this was a much better fit for him. There were a lot of gardens, a lot of outdoor space.
And cats.
And a lot of cats. Yeah, that's right. The garden provided, you know, access. So he had some feline visitors. You know, he started drawing again. And I think it's strange to say, but in the end, it really was kind of an upgrade for him. Like, he was free from these, you know, the domestic responsibilities we talked about, from his creditors and debtors, you know, and trying to just kind of be the breadwinner for his family. And he really just kind of got to let go and do what he loved, which, as we know, was draw cats.
And so there's this beautiful yet bittersweet note here, because, you know, a guy who never really cared to amass a fortune, who just loved his own art, is able to, as you said, Gabe, he's able to reach a kind of peace. And he lives this way, drawing art that he loves, until he passes from this mortal plane on July 4th, 1939. And on the way, his art is still evolving, by the way. It's becoming increasingly, what would you say, abstract? Do we want to talk about this?
We should definitely talk about this. Yeah. That he isn't making work anymore, you know, for publication. He's not trying to sell anything. There's no, you know, requests or deadlines or anything like that. He's really free to kind of flex his creative muscles and go where he wants with this. And he takes it to all kinds of different places. One in particular, on the more psychedelic end of things, he starts doing what's kind of referred to now as wallpaper cats. And that's because these are really elaborate patterns, a lot of symmetrical, colorful patterns.
Almost like fractal kind of looking in a way.
Yeah, yeah. Similar to stuff you'd find on wallpapers or Turkish rugs. And, you know, so it all kind of comes back. A lot of art historians are kind of, you know, suggesting that a lot of the influence was, yeah, memories of the patterns that his mother had worked on in his youth, wallpapers, you know, that had been in their house, and that he was kind of just all channeling that into his art and mixing in cats too. And yeah, it's you know, there's a case that's been made over the years that you can kind of trace the deterioration of his mind, you know, in the progression of this art, the way things do get more abstract and the cats kind of, you know, become these sort of cosmic. I mean, it really is trippy stuff if you look at it.
But it's incredible. And you know, there is sort of a silver lining in this, that he, you know, obviously was rescued from that pauper's ward and was quite beloved at Knapsbury, where he spent the last years of his life, and where his art began to progress into those kind of fractal psychedelic tapestries, right?
Yeah, just to jump in real quick. Yeah, I mean, they loved him there. He would even decorate the wards where he stayed every Christmas. He would do a big new design for the walls. And of course, it was always cats.
It's strange, because when he passes away, and I think maybe, not to read your minds, guys, but I think maybe this is something you might have been going toward as well, Noel. When he passes away, he is so beloved that people organize for a posthumous showing of his work, and people are celebrating him, they're memorializing him. However, his death, everybody who heard that date knows what's coming up. His death occurred on July 4th, 1939. He died in the UK. That's the same time that Britain enters World War II. And so for a while, he, you know, understandably is fading out of the headlines, while monsters like Adolf Hitler are taking up more and more space in the broadsheet.
So yeah, after he passed away, there was, you know, there've been a couple reinventions or kind of, you know, reinvigorations of interest in Wayne over the years. And one of them started when a guy named Dr. Walter McClay found 8 of Wayne's works from his kind of asylum years at a junk shop. And this is something that would eventually become known as the Famous Series. And, you know, it's again, it's held up as kind of, you can see the deterioration of his mind through the way that he depicted cats in this series of 8 different paintings. And, you know, the first 2 are fairly realistic. They've been described as Disney-ish affairs. So, you know, big, round, cutesy features, a lot of fluff. The third cat in the series is, you know, recognizable as a cat, but we get some of that kind of radiating outlines that we talked about earlier, you know, the electricity or the ether in the air. And then the five drawings after that are really kind of, I don't know how you would describe them, but they are more and more abstract as you go along. The cat kind of blurs out of focus. And instead you get kind of just these colorful shapes and fractals, you know, like kind of like you're looking at a cat's face through a kaleidoscope.
It's interesting, too, because McClay was actually a psychiatrist who just happened to be, you know, a fan of, like, you know, digging around in junk shops for art and, you know, collecting art. I just think it's really interesting that it happened to be someone who would have been familiar with this kind of diagnosis of mental illness that ended up kind of, you know, finding this stuff and being able to kind of, you know, apply that level of understanding to maybe what he was seeing in that progression, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And others in his field really kind of ran with this and took that famous series, you know, as kind of a case study in, you know, the deterioration of the mind when faced with something like schizophrenia. And that went on for decades. It was accepted. That's actually the first place that I came across Lewis Wayne's work. I think it was a Time magazine special or something from the 70s or 80s, this series they put out on the mind. And inside that was this famous series, and it was, you know, in the chapter about mental illness. But there's more to the story there, and, you know, whether or not this is actually grounded in any kind of legitimate science.
Ah, yes. Yeah. And Gabe, you had delved into a couple of different books here. This is one of the things we set up when we said we want to be sensitive about this, because it's so devilishly easy to hear something or see something and you just say, oh, that makes sense. Like, I see a progression. So clearly this is what the experts say it is. But you're right, upon revisiting some of this work, there's one writer we should bring into the reappraisal here. His name is Rodney Dale. He had purchased a Wayne illustration from, he was living in Cambridge, and he was lucky enough to get an original illustration of Wayne's. And he said, you know, this is amazing. I want to learn more about this guy, and I've got to investigate this. So I want more information about him. And this is sort of the mid-late 60s. He eventually learns as much as he can, and he finds a cache of artwork that had been stashed somewhere and forgotten under a bed. And then he publishes the book, Lewis Wayne, The Man Who Drew Cats. But it starts challenging McClay's earlier conclusions because, you know, the timeline doesn't really match up. Like, there's no chronological, there's no, like, chain of command, for lack of a better phrase, about where and how these were made. We just have eight that seem to illustrate something, but we don't know the gap between the paintings, you know, between like painting three or painting four, et cetera. So it pokes some holes in that, in McClay's theory.
That's really interesting because I feel kind of like a heel because I looked at it in the same way, just from, you know, an observational, obviously I'm not, you know, schooled in psychology or psychiatry, but that is how I interpret it as well. So really interesting. We know that psychology and psychiatry were evolving fields. And especially when we talk about the way mentally ill individuals were treated in those, you know, horrific asylum conditions in Wayne's early days when he was committed, these things evolve and they continue to evolve. And that's kind of what we're seeing here in this reinterpretation of this stuff in the 60s.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, eventually what came to light was that, you know, the connections that McClay made between these paintings were really just of his own invention. He just, you know, he stumbled across these eight images and placed them in an order that made sense to him and kind of fit the narrative that maybe he already had arrived at, you know, the conclusion. And yeah, there's just no evidence that, you know, these eight images follow a timeline, you know, that progression of his disease, that, you know, the one that's more realistic was made, you know, before the last one in the series that's really abstract. There's nothing to support that. And in fact, if you look at the work from those asylum years, yeah, there's a lot of those wallpaper cats and, you know, fractals and really psychedelic stuff. But there's also things that harken back to his earlier work where it's just kind of, you know, these tableaus of cats playing croquet or shooting pool, tug of war, a lot of activities that he would have been taking part in himself at that kind of nicer, higher end asylum. So, you know, the conclusions that McClay were drawing just don't really pass the smell test.
All too often the truth with surprisingly convenient science, you know, it doesn't automatically make it schizophrenia, right? It could have been something, but he could have just been continually evolving as an artist.
There's also this idea that they had to have been done in progression because they were all the same size. But that really was just a product of the fact that he was getting his art supplies from the hospital and they had standardized, you know, paper and art supplies and crafting stuff that they would give him. So that's why they were all the same size.
And there's one other interesting thing here. Now we're entering a bit of the realm of speculation, but we're not going to do you dirty the way that McClay did and can make a conclusion. We're going to have a little speculation here. If there was a mental issue that he was grappling with, it does not necessarily mean that mental issue was schizophrenia. One thing that was really fascinating to me about this is this. Maybe we can file this as under anti-cat propaganda, but this will be interesting to every cat lover out there. There have been some unsubstantiated guesses that perhaps Wayne was affected with something called toxoplasmosis gondii. Toxoplasmosis gondii, if he did have schizophrenia, if he did have a mental issue, it could have been caused by his love of cats. It's possible, if not probable, it's possible. This parasite moves from feline host to humans. Most people don't have any symptoms. It usually causes like a mild, you feel like you kind of have the flu and you get better, but it can cause some severe symptoms in a certain part of the population. Some people can have their mental functions impaired. A fact that made me think of our own LaBouche, a close associate of super producer Casey Pegram, is that toxoplasmosis is very common in some parts of the world. About 50% of the adult population of France is infected as we record today.
I'm probably oversimplifying this, but isn't that also the thing that kind of makes you a little more into cats?
Yes, I think you're right.
Those worms in your brain, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, to kind of theorize about that kind of thing, the connection with cats. They definitely pop up, you know, often through his life. There's a few good anecdotes I've come across. One was that, you know, despite what happened to him later in life, health wise, he was actually in pretty good health for most of his life and never really had to go to the hospital, except on one occasion in 1914, he actually fell off of a bus on Bond Street and spent the next 2 weeks in the hospital. And this was reported on. He was still kind of a public figure at the time. And the legend was that he had fallen off because the bus was swerving to avoid a cat.
So. Wait a minute. So sorry, just to clarify, when you say falling off of a bus, do you mean like out the door or like, was he like bus surfing or something? How does one fall off of a bus?
I'm picturing it's a double-decker bus because he's in London. I don't know the timeline of that exactly, if those were around, but that makes the most sense to me. So I'm going to go with that.
Checks out.
So he's kind of, you know, he's hanging off the way that the cool kids ride those double-decker buses, right? He's hanging off the rail, maybe waving to cats. This is fascinating because we've done a lot of stuff in this episode. We've busted a little bit of a myth, and you know, Noel, don't feel bad, because when I saw those things, I made the same assumptions. I don't think we're wrong to make those assumptions about the progression of quote unquote mental illness there, because they came from a psychiatrist, right? From a learned professional who should have done their due diligence and established that. So it's not entirely on us for falling for it, but we've busted that myth. We've learned a lot about this guy's life. And I don't know, you know, I'm grateful to him. I am grateful to Lewis Wayne.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, you saying that, that really hits the nail on the head. In that memorial exhibition that was that posthumous one shortly after he died and before, you know, World War II kicked off in earnest, there was the art critic at the Times of London. He kind of wrote what sort of works as Wayne's epitaph. He said, and it's very simple, but, quote, "As a man who gave simple pleasure to thousands, Mr. Wayne deserves to be remembered." And, you know, for a long time he wasn't, but I don't know. I mean, one reason I really wanted to talk about, you know, this topic was especially now, you know, at this time with everybody kind of hunkered down and finding, you know, little joys throughout the day wherever you can. It kind of, yeah, it makes me really kind of reevaluate the importance of people like that who just give you small little pleasures, little, you know, smiles through, you know, a silly cat picture or whatever that really keeps you going.
And I got to say, I am a huge fan of people that just pick a thing and run with it. And that is absolutely what this gentleman did.
So there you have it, ridiculous historians. This is the life and times of Lewis Wayne, the man who is more or less directly responsible for all of those top-notch cat memes that have brightened your day in the past and will continue, hopefully, to do so in the future. Thanks, as always, to Gabe. Gabe, I feel like we could just be on a first name basis now. This is so weird. It's so weird to have this. I'll say the R word for us to have this relationship with you and have this to be the first time we've talked and been able to see each other's faces. Before, it's only been on the phone.
How was it for you, Gabe? Make an assessment.
I mean, this was fantastic. You guys let me come on and just, you know, ramble on about one of my favorite artists. Yeah, it's been a blast. I definitely feel like, you know, this is a milestone in our relationship. And I hope we can continue from here. I'd love to come back sometime and talk about something else weird.
Oh, I think we're absolutely going to hold you to that offer because I think we both had a fantastic time as well.
Yeah, and that depends on our last and deciding vote. Check it in with you, Casey. What's the verdict?
The verdict is, I believe Gabe needs to come back, talk to us about more cool stuff.
All right, I'm in.
Casey, on the case. Rendering judgment. I love it. I really like that verdict.
Yes, yes. I retract my earlier statements about this being a kangaroo court. Gabe, you're stumbling into some weird longstanding. I don't even know if they're in jokes now. They're just how we hang out. But yes, thank you so much. Perhaps at some time you may even meet Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. Reluctant thanks to him. Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed this slap and track you hear at the beginning of every show.
Always huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit, Eve's Jeff Coates. Check out every cool thing that she's doing on the podcast network. And thanks to you, Ben. This was quite a romp. I really enjoyed myself today.
A romp of whimsy indeed. Yes. Thanks so much to you, Noel. And as always, most importantly, thanks to you, ridiculous historians. Let us know more strange stories of artists you would like us to explore in the future. You can find us all over the internet, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, still working on that Pinterest page. But maybe we'll invest in MySpace. I don't know. It's a long weekend coming up. But we can't wait to hear from you. You can also find us as individuals. If the spirit so moves you, I am at Ben Bolin on Instagram and at Ben Bolin HSW on Twitter.
You can find me exclusively on Instagram where I am at How Now Noel Brown. And please join our Facebook group, Ridiculous Historians, where you can interact with your fellow listeners and us, because we pop in there from time to time as well. You can also send us an email at ridiculous@iheartradio.com. And I think that covers it. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.